This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where the House of Representatives concluded 4 days of debate on the war in Iraq with a vote to oppose President Bush's plan to increase combat troops. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi called the vote at about 3 o'clock Eastern Time.
All time for debate has expired, and the previous question is ordered. The question is on adoption of the concurrent resolution. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it.
Madam Speaker, I request a
roll. I'm from Missouri.
I request a roll call vote, please.
One of the purposes of this debate was to put representatives on the record in a vote Democrats portrayed as for or against the president's escalation, Republicans as for or against support for troops engaged in combat. After the electronic roll call vote, the speaker announced the results.
146. The nays are 182. The concurrent resolution is accepted. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
The House microphones failed to pick up the first part of that tally. The vote was 246 in favor, 182 opposed. That result is no surprise. Democrats have the numbers to control the House, and they were virtually unanimous in support. But both the tenor of today's debate and the Republican vote offers points of interest. With me here in studio is NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. And Ron, thanks for coming in.
Good to be with you, Neil.
How did the Republican vote split?
Well, there were 17 Republicans who voted in favor of the resolution. Of course, the vast majority of Republicans voted against it, and there were several who just didn't vote at all. But there were 17 who voted in favor of the resolution, and that was, well, not exactly the number that the Democrats were predicting or hoping for. Nancy Pelosi said after the vote, gee, I only heard 12 Republicans speak for the resolution, so I was only counting on those 12. But plenty of other people in the Democratic leadership and among their aides were predicting, oh, 24 or maybe even 36 Republicans would vote for the resolution. So it was a disappointment for them.
And in fact, there was a theory that only a few Republicans would speak in favor of the resolution, but more would vote in favor of it, not speaking for fear of having the video of that used against them in some Republican primary down the road.
Precisely. And I thought that made a certain amount of logical sense. But in the end, most of the people, all but I think 4 or 5 of the people who were prepared to vote for the resolution, were also prepared to go out on the floor and tell the world what their reasons were. And, you know, I think it's interesting, too, that a lot of these people were folks who could really have it either way. They could go back to their district and tell folks one way or another which way they stood. So they were making what might be described as a kind of vote of conscience.
We should note, of course, 2 Democrats voted against the resolution as well. But getting back to that point you just made, it had been believed, Ron, that the Republicans who were elected in squeaker elections in last November, people like Christopher Shays in Connecticut, Heather Wilson in New Mexico, those might be the Republicans conditioned towards voting for the Democratic resolution, inoculating themselves against the anti-war vote next time around.
And in the case, for example, of Heather Wilson, she gave rather a tortured speech about why she didn't think the resolution went quite far enough to rescue the situation in Iraq and so on. But no, I don't think you can really find that pattern in these folks. I mean, you look down the list, there are some who had close races last time, but the preponderance of them did not. Most of them were people who won easily, will probably win easily again in 2008, and were clearly voting against the war because they or voting against the troop buildup because they feel that this war is in a sense a failure and that more troops is not the answer.
On this fourth day of debate, there was more clarity about what this resolution actually means. One of the standard Republican charges this week is that the resolution simply opposes the president's plan without offering an alternative. Yesterday, the Democratic leadership declared that this resolution is the first step toward a plan based roughly on the proposals of the Baker-Hamilton Commission, the Iraq Study Group, which Speaker Pelosi presented today as a 6-point plan.
So there we have the 6 elements: redeployment of troops, building of political consensus, engaging in diplomacy, reform of reconstruction, and a refocus on the war on terror. By placing so much emphasis instead on dealing with the problems in Iraq militarily and not enough emphasis on sustained political and diplomatic engagement, the president's escalation plan repeats past mistakes. The stakes in Iraq are too high to recycle proposals that have little prospect for success. The bipartisan resolution today may be non-binding, but it will send a strong message to the President. We here in Congress are committed to protecting and supporting our troops.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who went on to declare that passage of this legislation will signal a change in direction that will end the fighting and bring our troops home safely. In response, Ileana Ross-Layton of Florida, the top Republican on the House International Affairs Committee, portrayed the non-binding resolution as the first step that would lead to a series of funding cuts and a series of retreats.
What is the next step in the strategy, Madam Speaker, after the crippling of our war effort? We know from statements and bills that have been introduced that plans will mandate the nature and the timing of a withdrawal by placing limitations on the funding of our efforts. A vote for this resolution, then, is a vote to proceed toward defunding of our troops. Some believe that the impact of these decisions is confined to Iraq, but Iraq is only one front in the global war against radical Islamic jihadists. This is a war without boundaries. This is a war that poses the greatest challenge to our generation. Once the retreat has started, where will it stop? Afghanistan, the Persian Gulf, the entire Middle East? Once we have abandoned our allies in Iraq, why should anyone in the world believe when we say that we draw a line in the sand and say that we will never abandon them? While urging a withdrawal, some state that they support the troops. But as leaders of the American Legion and the Veterans for Foreign Wars have stated, you cannot separate the warrior from the war.
And Ron Elving, while we listened to this debate, there were moments where you could almost hear Republican talking points arrive on the floor. Speaker, after about 11 o'clock this morning, denounced what they called the slow bleed. And what did they mean by that? Where did that come from?
It came essentially from the program that John Murtha, the Democrat from Pennsylvania, who heads up the Defense Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee, has laid out for essentially making it impossible for the president to carry out his troop buildup in Iraq. He wants to set limits on how long people can be sent to Iraq. He wants to put a limit on the so-called stop-loss program, which pulls people back into the military who otherwise would be mustering out. He wants to get involved in a lot of the personnel assignments so as to make this troop surge virtually impractical or impossible.
And that, Republicans say, is micromanaging the war. They raise questions about whether it impinges on the constitutional prerogatives of the president as commander-in-chief, but it's also a political point. And did Congressman Murtha's arguments in that interview yesterday and Speaker Pelosi's basic endorsement of them, did they end up costing the Democrats votes today, do you think?
I suspect they probably did. There probably were a few Republicans. I don't think, by the way, they cost the two Democrats who went the other way. But I think it might have cost them some of the Republican votes they were thinking they might get. I couldn't put a number on it, but it could have been fairly substantial because it made it too pointed, a suggestion that this was a first step towards something that could be called defunding the troops, mm-hmm. a first step towards a Congress attempt to really take over the management of the war. Now, if you're a Republican, you may be against the way the war has been run, and you may be against the disappointments or whatever you want to call them that have taken place in Iraq, but you don't want to be seen supporting a Democratic takeover of the war that displaces President Bush. That's something that was too much, I think, for some of the Republicans who otherwise might have voted for the resolution.
Earlier in the week, a Republican tactical document was leaked which said that, look, if this is a vote about the president and the surge, we lose. If it's a vote about the global war on terror and support for the troops, we can win, or at least limit the damage. And that seems to be, from their point of view, what happened.
You know, at one point this morning, Harold Rogers, a senior Republican from Kentucky, got up and he said this to begin. I rise to support our troops and our country. Pause. It's really that simple. And I think a lot of the Republican debate sounded exactly like that. They continually criticized the resolution for being non-binding, to suggest it was in some sense invalid or unworthy. They did talk about the effect of the morale of the troops, and that's where Vietnam came up repeatedly. Talked about emboldening enemies. In fact, that verb embolden, I think, will be one of the things we remember from this debate. They talked continually about General David Petraeus, whom the Senate unanimously confirmed to be our new commander in Iraq, saying, you cannot hate the war and love the warrior. If you are approving the general, you must approve his mission and his plan. And that was about it. That was the tight list, and we heard that list again and again in every five-minute speech.
Mm-hmm. We should point out Democrats had their themes, too. Well, we're in the next segment of the program, we're going to be listening to substantial excerpts from many of the speeches today. The Democratic theme was simply, we got into this war, it was a mistake to get into the war, and we're just compounding the mistake if we send an additional 20,000-plus troops into a meat grinder, is another phrase that's going to be coming out of this debate, I think.
More troops not being the answer. A failed policy is not rescued by sending in more troops. We're refereeing a civil war between two sides or three or four in an ancient sectarian rivalry we're not going to be able to solve. It's a swamp. It's a quagmire we have to get out. And the polls are against this troop buildup. Again and again, we heard how the American people, 60-some percent, opposed the idea of the buildup, and more than 50% thought it was time to start withdrawing. In fact, in some polls, more than 60% support getting all American troops out by sometime in 2008. And finally, another Democratic point we heard just as often as those Republican points was that Iraq is not really part of the war on terror. It's time we got refocused on Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and defeating them.
Mm. And Democrats are determined to pursue the war on terror, but not the war in Iraq. As you said, two separate things. Stay with us. Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor, and we'll be back with more after a short break. We're going to be listening to substantial excerpts of today's speeches in the House of Representatives. The highlights, some of the words and phrases we heard come up again and again through 4 days of debate. I'm Neil Conan. Back in a minute. You're listening to a special report from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, this is a special report on today's vote in the House of Representatives. The resolution opposing the president's troop increase for Iraq passed 246 for, 182 against. 17 Republicans voted in favor, 2 Democrats against. I'm Neil Conan. With me here in the studio is NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. And Ron, as the week progressed, you could start to pick out certain similarities of words or phrases on both sides, as we mentioned earlier. On the Republican side today, members attacked the plan put forward by Representative John Murtha, a Democrat, to target funding for the war. And as we mentioned, they dubbed this the slow bleed strategy.
Sooner than you imagine, this non-binding resolution will instigate binding legislation to commence a, quote, slow bleed, end quote, of funding cuts while our troops battle against the enemy.
On one hand, offering rhetorical support for the troops, and on the other, advancing a slow bleed strategy.
Some now talk about a slow bleed strategy to cut off funding for our troops.
For the Democrats, we heard variations on the theme of mistake.
Tragically, the president and his administration are dealing with an Iraq that exists only in their imagination.
We're here today because of a series of irretrievable strategic mistakes.
Congress has done absolutely nothing in the face of mistake after mistake after mistake in Iraq.
And Ron, the appearance or the recurrence of these words and phrases over and over again, this is no coincidence.
It's about as accidental as our being here in this studio at the same time every night. This is terribly carefully coordinated, and they really want to drive home one or two thoughts. And if you have Well, we had almost 400 people give speeches in the course of this 4 days. If we had 400 separate thoughts, obviously, it would not be as predictable what people would take away from the debate.
Hmm. At times, this debate seemed like a succession of speeches. One speaker, member from each side, parading up to the microphone in the well of the House of Representatives and going on seemingly unconnected to anything that had happened before or anything was likely to come after. But there were moments when representatives engaged each other. Early today, Republican Lynn Westmoreland of Georgia went on to cite the Democratic presidents of the 20th century.
I wonder what the forebears of today's Democratic Party would think of their policy of retreat and defeat. What would they think of the timidity in the face of great danger? What happened to the legacy of Woodrow Wilson, who faced down American skeptics to lead us to victory in World War I? What happened to the legacy of FDR, who faced down American isolationists to defeat the evils of German fascism and the militarism of Imperial Japan? What happened to the legacy of Harry Truman, the first president to realize the peril of the Soviets and entered our war-weary nation into the fight against the spread of communism? The wisdom of their decisions wasn't necessarily clear to all Americans of their day, but the judgment of history validates their leadership. Today, our commander-in-chief sees the danger to our nation's security and freedom posed by Islamic extremist forces in the Middle East. If we were to follow the proposals of the Democratic leaders, we would pull out our troops and let Iraq become a failed state. By the end of this week, every member of this House will be on the record and answerable to their constituents about whether they are for or against the military plan. My colleagues who vote for this resolution are for one of two things. They are either for retreat and defeat or stay the course.
Republican Lynn Westmoreland of Georgia. He was followed by the Democrat Barney Frank from Massachusetts.
Mr. Speaker, we have just heard a great example of an important form of political debate. The Republicans specialize in it. It's kind of political necrophilia. There is this love of dead Democrats among many Republicans. Democrats who, when they were alive, were trashed by the right wing. Once they are dead and safely no longer possibly candidates for office, get lionized. Nothing, of course, shows that better than with Harry Truman, but it's John Kennedy and it's others. The assertion that the Democrats who are supporting this resolution and the unspoken Republicans who will be joining with us, that we somehow oppose the use of force, is terrible history. It is wrong. In fact, the most recent entirely successful use of military force by the United States came from a Democratic president, Bill Clinton. He's still alive, so don't say good things about him. And supported by Democrats in Congress, and it was opposed by many of the Republicans, including many of the current Republican leadership. Under Bill Clinton, American military forces were used quite successfully, and the result is not perfection, but a much better situation in the former Yugoslavia than we had before. And the Republicans brought forth, guess what, non-binding resolutions.
Democrat Barney Frank of Massachusetts. Ron Elving, there's a lot of frustration expressed by people listening to the debate over the fact that so many people seem to have their minds made up going in. Were any minds changed, do you think? Did people listen to this debate with that in mind?
I don't believe many minds were changed. I think some votes might have been changed because these votes are determined largely on the basis of political calculation. And if in the course of the 4-day debate, and particularly with regard to this slow bleed argument that, legitimate or not, was brought up at a highly strategic moment when obviously a handful of Republicans were making their final decision which way to vote. Those kinds of things can change the political calculation for certain individual congressmen, even in the last hour. There was also this mood of the very final hour of the debate in which Sam Johnson, the veteran from Texas who served 7 years in a POW camp in Vietnam, recounted his torture in great detail. That obviously changed the mood on the floor. He was given a standing ovation, certainly by all the Republicans. Many of the Democrats joined in. And that also could have had a last-moment effect. But did that really change what anybody really thinks about what's going on in Iraq? I don't believe so.
There were comparisons drawn to the debate to authorize the use of force against Iraq before the first Gulf War. A debate went all night long in the House of Representatives. Again, everybody got 5 minutes to speak. How do you think this compared?
In 1991, there was a general sense, I think, on the part of everyone who took part in the debate on the first Persian Gulf War, House and Senate, and all those of us who watched and reported on it, that this was Congress at its best, that people really were listening to each other, that minds were in many cases open. But consider that that was a war that hadn't happened yet. That was a war in which people were trying to decide how to respond to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. The stakes were somewhat different. We had not 4 years in. We didn't have 3,100 casualties, that is 3,100 dead, tens of thousands of people wounded, the enormous damage that's already happened in Iraq, none of those things. So it was a quite different situation, a little bit more abstract, a little bit less emotional, and I think a lot more open minds were actually made up in the course of that debate.
Each side, as we've mentioned, had certain points of emphasis. We're going to hear first from two Democrats on the costs of the war. And this is, to begin with, John Spratt of South Carolina.
So far, over 3,100 servicemen and women have been killed in action. So far, over 23,000 have been wounded in action, many of them grievously. And so far, Congress has appropriated $379 billion for the war in Iraq. As we speak, two supplemental appropriation bills are on deck. These bills, when passed, will push appropriations for the war in Iraq over $600 billion. $600 billion. When the 08 supplemental is added to the 08 base budget, these two will push appropriations for fiscal year 2008 alone to $643 billion. In constant dollars, that's more than we spent at the peak of Korea or Vietnam. To support this surge, the President has called for five brigades, 21,500 additional troops. And he sent us a supplemental of $3.2 billion to pay for these troops. But CBO says, how about the support troops? How about the staff? This will cost billions more. CBO has also looked out 10 years and tried to figure what future costs might be. By its estimation, future operations in Iraq and Afghanistan together could come to $824 billion between 2008 and 2017. And mind you, this assumes that the troops deployed in these theaters will be declining. Surely, at this juncture, spending heads upwards to more than $10 billion a month, surely we should ask whether we want to raise our commitment of troops and thrust them into a civil war with no clear exit, no timetable for completion, and worse still, an urban war.
And again, this on the subject of costs, Representative Al Green, a Democrat from Texas.
Mr. Speaker, with this money, according to CNN and the National Priorities Project, we could have hired 6.4 million public school teachers. We could have built 3.3 million public housing units. We could have insured 220 million children for 1 year. And on a more lofty level, Mr. Speaker, America has helped the Iraqi people develop a constitution. We've helped the Iraqis to establish democratic elections. We have helped the Iraqis reconstitute their military and overhaul their constabulary. Mr. Speaker, after all that we have done, more than 23,000 wounded, after all that we have done, 3,100 dead, after all that we have done, more than $267 million per day, after all that we have done, whenever we leave, it won't be cut and run.
And that was Al Green, a Democrat from Texas. On the other side of the aisle, Republicans repeatedly emphasized the effect of this vote on troops in the field. This is Republican John Sullivan of Oklahoma, who accused the Democrats of hypocrisy.
I rise today in strong opposition to this pretend, fake, disingenuous, cruel-to-the-troops resolution. It is impossible, despite what the Democrats have claimed, to both support the troops and not support increase in troops necessary to win the war. With this non-binding, fake, pretend resolution, Democrats maintain they support the troops, but at the same time disapprove of their mission. This confusing message simply lends encouragement to the Iraqi insurgents and terrorists to believe that every roadside bomb brings them closer to their goal of a terrorist state in the heart of the Mideast. The simple fact is the deployment of troops to secure Baghdad has already begun. In fact, soldiers of the 82nd Airborne Division who were deployed after President Bush's call for a temporary increase in troops are already in Iraq doing critical work with the Iraqi security forces. The passage of this misguided pretend resolution does nothing except demoralize these brave men and women in uniform and invigorate those who wish America great harm.
And Jim Gerlach, Republican of Pennsylvania, took up the same theme.
It serves to undercut the morale and the support of our fighting men and women at the very time they're carrying out their orders. The president's decision of January 10th is now being implemented. Our troops are already carrying out this mission in the field. I know of no instance in our nation's history when Congress has passed a resolution disapproving a mission while that mission is in progress in the field. Can any proponent of this resolution come to the floor and cite a case where Congress has undertaken this type of action while a mission is already underway? Any politician, it seems to me, who openly disapproves of an ongoing mission in the field only undercuts troop spirit and morale as they move forward. And that clearly lends support to the aims and the goals of our enemies.
And Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, as you listen to these arguments, on the Republican side, the president's plan is already in operation. That first brigade of the five brigades he's going to send to Baghdad and Anbar province, that first brigade from the 82nd Airborne, already on the ground there in Iraq. You can't deny the general who was approved by unanimous vote in the United States Senate. You can't deny the general the reinforcements he needs to carry out the plan that you voted for him to go and enact.
Those are the arguments, but I think that particularly with respect to General Petraeus, the Democrats in the Senate would say, all right, we voted for him because we thought he was the best general that the president could offer us at this particular moment, and we have no particular objection to him. Give us a chance now to vote on the plan that the president wants him to carry out, and we will give him a different set of marching orders. I don't think that they have any problem with that in the Senate, and certainly over in the House, I suspect that the Democrats there have no problem with David Petraeus. What they have a problem with is the president's plan for how to go forward in Iraq. With respect to some of these other matters, I mean, emboldening the enemies of the United States. Is there a sense that the enemies of the United States in Iraq at this particular time are lacking in boldness? Or do we feel that the main fighting that we're trying to deal with in Iraq is even about the enemies of the United States? Or is it more about the enemies of one Iraqi fighting the enemies of another Iraqi? The Sunni versus the Shia, the different struggles among the Shia. Secretary of Defense Bob Gates himself has testified that he counts four different wars going on in Iraq right now that the United States is trying to deal with. So a great deal of the debate that we've heard over the last 4 days on the Republican side seems to be about a certain concept of the war, something more along the lines of a World War II model, a Korean War model, even a Vietnam War model. And in fact, I would argue they talked more about those wars than they actually talked about the facts on the ground in Baghdad or Iraq. We heard all about those wars, and we heard all about how the right strategy there would have been one thing or another, but in no case did that seem to be precisely fit to what's actually going on, even in Bob Gates' estimate in Iraq.
The cost argument presented by the Democrats, Republicans would respond that, yes, this has cost more than we initially anticipated, but given the stakes involved, the stability of the Middle East, the well-being of American troops in the field, the potential threat of al-Qaeda remounting itself in training camps in a post-war Iraq, given all those things, the sacrifices, as terrible as they have been, cost should not be an object.
That's right. They have argued at one point, Peter King, the ranking member on the Homeland Security Committee, said, this isn't a vote about Iraq. It's not a vote about one troop buildup. This is a vote about the future of our civilization and defending it against jihadists who would destroy it. So if you're talking about that, if that's how you conceive of the choice to be made, then what price in dollars could be too high.
And we're getting also into an area of politics. We're going to listen to one more clip of tape in this segment of the program. And this is Ginny Brown-Waite, a Republican from Florida. And this was another Republican argument you heard throughout the day, that what we were seeing here was just old politics.
Unfortunately, this vote and the debate that we are having is about politics and providing some political cover. It does nothing to help our soldiers win. Remember, it is a non-binding resolution. What does that mean? It means that we could talk, as my mother used to say, until the cows come home, and it has absolutely no effect. It has no power, no teeth, and absolutely no effect. To be more specific, there is not one single mention in the Democrat resolution of how we will send more body armor for the troop, not a single mention of new tools to detect IED explosives, not one word dedicated to up-armored Humvees. And, Mr. Speaker, not one mention of the method to fund the health care needs of the veterans who come home.
And that was Ginny Brown Waite, a Republican from Florida. And, of course, this was a vote about politics, Ron Elving. But, nevertheless, this had to have been seen not just as a vote on the president's proposed plan to increase the number of forces in Baghdad and Anbar province. This was a vote, the first opportunity the House had had in years for a major vote and debate on the war in Iraq.
Yes, and the Democrats wanted a chance to express their extreme unhappiness about how the war has gone and to put responsibility for it on President Bush and to say the best way for the country to show its dissatisfaction with all of this is to reject the president's plan for a troop buildup for, if you will, as one of them said, stay the course on steroids. The Republicans, of course, can characterize that, as this particular representative did, as just the Democrats having their licks against the president, driven by constituencies that helped elect them last November, and indeed they did, and delivered control of the chamber to the Democrats so that this debate could take place in the first place. It certainly was not going to have taken place over the last 6 years with the Republican majority in the House. So, yes, there are political considerations in it all, but I've found it curious all week that people kept coming back to this non-binding. If it's so meaningless and so toothless, why did it take 400 speeches and nearly 45 hours of debate with the emotions running as high as they did?
We'll have more on today's vote in the House after a short break and play back some of the final words on both sides after four long days of debate, plus highlights from the earlier part of the week, the arguments and exchanges that led up to today's vote. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to a special report from NPR News. This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, the House of Representatives voted to oppose President Bush's troop buildup in Iraq. The vote was largely along party lines, but 17 Republicans voted in favor of the Democratic resolution. Two Democrats voted with most of the Republicans opposed. With me here in the studio is Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor. And there was, as Ron mentioned earlier in this broadcast, an emotional moment at the end of the debate. The Republicans chose to conclude their list of speakers with Sam Johnson, a Republican from Texas, a man who served as a pilot in both Korea and Vietnam. In Vietnam, he was shot down and held prisoner for many long years, 7 years a prisoner in North Vietnamese jails, along with other members of Congress, including, of course, famously John McCain. Sam Johnson recalled his terrible experiences in Vietnam and what he and his fellow prisoners had vowed to do when they learned of what was going on back home.
We POWs were still in Vietnam when Washington cut the funding for Vietnam. I know what it does to morale and mission success. Words cannot fully describe the horrendous damage of the anti-American efforts against the war back home to the guys on the ground. Our captors would blare nasty recordings over the loudspeaker of Americans protesting back home, tales of Americans spitting on Vietnam veterans when they came home, and worse. I don't think we should ever, ever let that happen again. The pain inflicted by your country's indifference is tenfold that inflicted by your ruthless captors. Our troops and their families want, need, and deserve the full support of this country and the Congress. The grim reality is that this House measure is the first step to cutting funding of the troops. Just ask John Murtha about his slow bleed plan that hamstrings our troops in harm's way. Now it's time to stand up for my friends who did not make it home and those who fought and died in Iraq already, so I can keep my promise that when we got home, we would quit griping about the war and do something positive about it. We must not allow this Congress to leave these troops like the Congress left us. Today, let my body serve as a brutal reminder that we must not repeat the mistakes of the past. Instead, learn from them. We must not cut funding for our troops. We must stick by them. We must support them all the way. And to our troops, we must remain always faithful. God bless you all. I salute you and this Congress.
Sam Johnson, Republican of Texas, left to a standing ovation. The applause went on for some minutes as he wound up the Republican arguments opposed to the resolution. The last speaker for the Democrats was Ike Skelton, Democrat of Missouri, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, who began his remarks by honoring first his colleague who had just spoken, and then decided to end the Democratic side of the arguments in a lower key.
As a result, under the president's plan, U.S. military forces will be less ready to go into during and after this troop increase, and sadly, they could be stretched to the point of breaking. Now, finally, I oppose the White House's plan because it will heighten the already unacceptable level of strategic risk currently facing our nation. Strategic risk that exists because our military is overcommitted in Iraq and is ill-equipped and ill-positioned to respond to emerging crises elsewhere in the world. And this worries me. It worries me deeply. Unfortunately, it is a magnificent, wonderful, courageous men and women of our military who will pay the price for that failure. Madam Speaker, we must send the White House a message that cannot be ignored. And that's what we are here today. I urge that we pass the Skelton-Lantos-Jones resolution. I yield back.
Ike Skelton, Democrat of Missouri. Immediately after that, the vote was called, and the Democrats prevailed. The non-binding resolution was approved with the votes of 17 Republicans, as well as all but two of the Democrats. NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Ike Skelton said, send a message to the White House. Do you think it was received?
Well, the reaction at the White House this afternoon was essentially, I can read a little bit of this from Tony Snow, the president's press secretary. He said the House has passed a resolution expressing disapproval of the president's plan. And then he, of course, immediately cites David Petraeus, the commander of the multinational force in Iraq, who was recently confirmed to his post by 81-0 vote in the Senate, and walks through two or three of the other talking points that we'd heard. The resolution is non-binding. The Congress shouldn't really have anything to do with the management of the war itself, and so on. The president himself, at the time of the vote, during the 3 o'clock hour, was receiving a little outpatient surgery to remove two moles from his face, which the doctors have said they're sure are benign. And was not actually watching much of the debate. The president and his press secretary have said that he doesn't need to watch the House debate to know what the people in the House think. And I think that's probably true. Ultimately, this debate appears to be about whether the best way to serve our troops, to whom everyone has expressed the same devotion, whether the best way to support those troops is to follow the president's plan, whatever it may be, because it is the president's plan, or whether we should start talking in realistic terms about bringing people home on a certain timetable. In other words, committing to withdrawal and trying to make the best of things in the meantime so as to facilitate that withdrawal. Mm. Those are the two opposing views.
And now let's go to Capitol Hill and NPR's congressional correspondent, Andrea Seabrook, to find out where we go from here. Andrea, nice of you to be with us.
Hello, glad to be here.
And what happened after the vote? You usually have a progression of people from both sides coming up to microphones in the Capitol, claiming victory for both sides.
Well, it was kind of a funny reaction. You know, the week started out on that sort of historic note, and you could look forward at the beginning of the week to a kind of end that might include a lot of, you know, high fives among Democrats. But it didn't end that way. Today, the Democrats had sort of their victory press conference, and the first question was, so what's all this about the slow bleed? What's going to happen next? When are we going to see the funding bill? It was almost as if the week hadn't happened. It was just, what's next? What's next? And I think that's appropriate, given the events that happened over the week, the fact that Jack Murtha, the chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, let go this idea that this was just the first step and that the real work was coming up next. It ended up being, I don't know, maybe less weighty after all of that.
Mm-hmm. There is also the question of what happens on the other side of the Capitol. The United States Senate, the Democratic Majority Leader, Harry Reid of Nevada, called a meeting for horrors of horrors for many senators on a Saturday.
On a Saturday, which, you know, everyone's running around here in Capitol Hill just to give you an inside look saying, how could he do that? They didn't do anything all week, and now we're going to meet on Saturday. So, I mean, the Senate is now getting in on the act. They're actually going to hold a vote, a procedural vote, on whether to go forward with this bill that the House is sending them. I think there's some stinging feelings over on the Senate side about the fact that the House did this first. And I think that we'll have to see how it goes on the other side.
But they begin with that cloture vote. And again, they're going to need 60 votes. That's going to require the votes of more than several Republicans in order to get the resolution onto the floor to be debated.
Well, most people over here are saying there are, here meaning the House of Representatives, are saying that clearly there are votes over there enough to pass this. The problem with the first Iraq resolution was how it was worded and the amendments that got attached to it and so on. This, the Democrats' Iraq resolution that they wrote in the House, for all of the talk of what it would do, is actually very simple. It's 97 words long, and all it basically says is, we support the troops, and we disapprove of the president's surge strategy. And the thought is right now that since it is that simple, it is more likely to garner the votes needed on the Senate side, the Republican votes needed for it to pass.
Mm-hmm. And let's get back to the House side. Was there any word from Congressman Murtha or from Speaker Pelosi on when we can expect those next bills that would actually put some teeth into what the House voted on today?
Well, all of those busy eyes are now trained on what will be coming out of that Defense Appropriations Subcommittee with the war funding supplemental request will be the first thing we'll see. This was the request from President Bush to keep funding the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Jack Murtha has said that he is combing that bill, looking for programs that he can defund, basically move money into training and equipping the troops better. And I think this is a fascinating political strategy, a chess game that you see coming up here, that how can Republicans vote against training and equipping the troops better before they're sent? And I think you are seeing a strategy develop that may train and equip this surge to death, in a way.
Mm-hmm. So the next phrase we're going to be hearing in the next debate is probably Trojan horse, as Republicans complain that this is not what the bill is actually intended to do. But in terms of timing, when might some of this legislation actually make its way out of Jack Murtha's subcommittee to the full committee onto the floor?
Well, I've been told that we're having it on the floor, the House will have it on the floor March 12th, the week of March 12th. So in just 4 weeks, next week's a recess. And I think right when we come back, the House and newsmakers in Washington, on February 26th, we're going to start seeing what's called markup sessions in those committees. They'll actually start attaching things and detaching things and really doing the sausage making of this supplemental.
Mm-hmm. Andrea Seabrook, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate
You're
your time. And Ron Elving, while the House and the Senate are either away or talking about other issues, the president regains the strategic initiative, if you will, and there is nothing to block him from going ahead with the buildup of troops in Iraq as he laid out back on January 10th.
Absolutely nothing, because the House has passed a non-binding resolution that depends on the Senate concurring even to be a non-binding resolution. And the Senate is probably not going to concur, at least not in any kind of short order, because tomorrow when they have this vote for cloture, there's no indication that there will be 60 votes to cut off debate and proceed to a vote on the House language. So we expect another stymieing situation there. And then the Senate and the House both go off for this week-long 10-day recess, as they call it, and they travel and they do this and that, and some of them go back to their districts. And then when they return, they will take all these questions up again. Maybe the Senate will act on the House language. Maybe it never will. And then it'll be several weeks before, as Andrea was saying, we actually make the sausage of this appropriation for the supplemental costs for Iraq and Afghanistan in the current fiscal year. That's really where the rubber meets the road. But it's weeks away. In the meantime, the brigades are deploying. They're going to be in action. We're going to start seeing some results of how well this strategy may work. Very early to make any kind of judgments, of course, but we're going to see reality unfold. The president is in a position to proceed with his policy in the meantime.
And the people who voted today are in some respects hostages to fortune, given what happens. It was the president at his news conference earlier in the week said, basically, we can talk all day long, I can talk all day long. It doesn't matter what I say, it doesn't matter what people in the House of Representatives say. What matters is what happens on the ground in Iraq.
And I think he was exactly right about that. And I think that an awful lot of people have looked back to that statement and thought, there you have it. There's your touchstone moment. I mean, it may not be quite the touchstone of mission accomplished back in 2003, but it's going to be another one of the moments along the timeline of this war, this entire global war on terror even, that people look back to and say, that was another demarcation point.
And looking back on this debate now that it's over, was there any serious belief on either side that this was actually going to affect the implementation of the president's plan?
I believe that some Democrats held it in their minds that if they could pull enough Republicans over behind this very simple, pared-down language that said really very little other than, we love the troops, and we don't think the president's got the best plan, we think he ought to do something different. It's, I think, possible to imagine that if the House had a fairly bipartisan vote for that, and that the Senate then could get 60 votes to proceed to it and pass it with some smaller figure, perhaps, a simple majority, after they had gotten the 60 votes to cut off debate, that you might actually have such a united front from Congress that the president might actually theoretically stop and say, maybe I should reconsider, maybe we do need to, in some sense, negotiate with Congress how we go forward.
Didn't happen and doesn't look like it's going to, with just 17 Republicans voting for the resolution. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Neil.
We close with highlights from the week's debate in the U.S. House of Representatives, and you're going to hear, in order, Patrick Murphy, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, House Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers from Michigan, Steve Pierce, Republican from New Mexico, Walter Jones, Republican from North Carolina, Gregory Meeks, a Democrat from New York, John Carter, Republican from Texas, and finally from Florida, Republican Ileana Ross-Leighton.
Walking in my own combat boots, I saw firsthand this administration's failed policy in Iraq.
Last fall, the American people spoke loudly with their votes. We should be here showing the voters that we heard them and that their trust was well placed.
My friends, you will not be able to appease the left with this toothless resolution that you're presenting. You know that your own members have called for defunding. This resolution empowers our enemy, encourages our enemy, and encourages those people who are going to disrespect our soldiers. I recommend a vote against the resolution.
But I remember in 1999 when we were on the floor as a majority party criticizing President Clinton for going into Bosnia. That was a non-binding resolution. That is what the Congress is about. Debate, disagreements, agreement, debate. That is our constitutional responsibility.
And in fact, I think that by having every member having the opportunity to speak on this floor, to talk about their patriotism, is exactly what's supposed to happen on the People's House.
We all know, in time, the war will be defunded one way or another, and the troops will come home. So why not now?
Let us not just support our troops. Let's support their mission, and their mission is to defeat the Islamic extremist. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Even today, after the votes were cast, there was considerable disagreement within and among both parties as to what this resolution really means. It is certainly a rebuke to the president, but it does not force him to do anything, and it's far from clear that the Democratic leadership can make good on its promise to move ahead to binding legislation that would block additional troop increases. Critics on both the right and the left will dismiss the resolution as toothless, the 45 hours of debate as a waste of time. But this vote, like the vote to authorize the war, may well be remembered as a political marker to hold each representative accountable as the war proceeds and as the debate continues. You've been listening to a special report from NPR News, coverage of the debate in the House of Representatives on a resolution that opposed the president's plan for a troop buildup in Iraq. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.